after graduation, as well as the school's graduation rate and default rate. Already 96 private and public institutions have signed on, with another 1,500 doing it for veterans. The goal is to take the mystery out of college costs and pricing schemes. But unless Congress steps in to make it mandatory, schools appear to be in no hurry to sign up. Claudia Sanchez, NPR News.
A technical failure prevented today's scheduled docking of an unmanned Russian cargo spaceship with the International Space Station. Russian space officials say they'll try again on Sunday. A Japanese cargo ship is due to arrive at the space station on Friday. Two Americans are among the space station's current crew. I'm Dave Mattingly, NPR News, in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the William and Flora Hewlett Foundation, making grants to solve social and environmental problems at home and around the world on the web at hewlett.org.
WILL programming is made possible by the University of Illinois School of Music, presenting Anglo-American Musical Connections, a concert in honor of Nicholas Temperley on his 80th birthday, this Saturday at 7:30 p.m. at the Krannert Center for the Performing Arts. For more information, visit KrannertCenter.com.
Good morning and welcome to Focus, our morning talk program. Today's first hour comes from the Focus Archives, so as you listen, keep in mind we will not be taking calls.
Good morning and welcome to Focus. This is our morning talk program. My name's David Inge, and we're glad to have you with us. Knowing where you have been is essential to knowing who you are and where you are going. And to that end, our brains take fleeting bits of information and they put them together to construct a version of our past. In this part of Focus, we will be talking a little bit about the formation of memories on two levels. On the personal level, when we're talking about individuals, but also on the level of groups of people, on the societal level. We have two guests here this morning, and we'll be talking about a book which they have co-authored that looks at memory consolidation for people, how that works. But they make this argument that, in fact, there is something that we can call a collective memory, and it works very much like memory works on the individual level. Our guests here in studio with us today, Thomas Anastasio. He is associate professor in the Department of Molecular and Integrative Physiology. He's also a member of the Beckman Institute for Advanced Science and Technology at University of Illinois. He is the co-author of the book Individual and Collective Memory Consolidation. The subtitle is Analogous Processes on Different Levels, and basically that just means what I've already said. It makes some comparisons between what happens in individuals and what happens in society. The book is published by the MIT Press, and he has several co-authors, and they are all PhD candidates at the University of Illinois, and we have one of them with us here also this morning, Wenyi Zheng. He is a PhD candidate in anthropology. Well, thank you both very much
for
being
here. Thank you, David.
There's a lot here, but just as a way of beginning, let me talk just a little bit about memory.
Okay.
And here's the question that I think people will be able to grab onto, and it's something that certainly I know that psychologists and people interested in the brain have been thinking about for a long time. And here's kind of the way I think about it. I think people will probably have had an experience like this. You could give someone a phone number, and they can remember it long enough to dial the number, and then it's gone. But if you ask me the telephone number of the house where I grew up, I could tell you that like that. And it's been a very long time since I've dialed that number. So the question is, you can't remember everything. How is it that some things just pass through and others become a part of your memory and they're things that you will just never forget?
That's a great question, because that basically illustrates the problem of memory. You can't remember everything. And we essentially have two kinds of declarative memory, memory for facts, short-term and long-term. And as everyone pretty much commonly knows, a lot of memory involves transfer from short-term to long-term stores. So when I give you a phone number and you can dial it 30 seconds later, it's in your short-term memory. More specifically, it might be in your working memory. You probably lose it after a while. But certain things in our short-term memory ultimately become consolidated into long-term memory, like the number from your house when you were a little kid. And why did that one become consolidated and not others? Well, probably because you repeated it so often, because you effortfully transferred it. You had to pay attention to it. Your mother told you have to remember this if you get in trouble, and so there was a certain arousal associated with that memory. So it tended to that made it a kind of a stable point in your long-term memory. Mm. But that's really what we're talking about today, is we're talking about the transfer from short-term to long-term memory and how that happens in individuals and how it happens in collectives. Okay. And I might go further and say that it isn't just the transfer. The transformation from short-term to long-term memory isn't just making a certain memory more permanent. It really involves reorganization of memory, because what your long-term memory is not just a kind of a permanent list of facts just of the same organization as short-term memory. What your brain really does, and what a society does, is it takes all these different facts and it places them into a coherent, meaningful system of relationships, and it's that system of relationships that is transferred into long-term memory as a more permanent store.
And that's, I don't know if this is getting in too much into another area, but I think that it's also interesting because people, I imagine, when people think about memory and what memory is, they look for a kind of a model that they can understand and probably think, oh, well, it's like a big tape library, right? So I'm trying to remember something that happened to me when I was a kid, and so I go to the shelf and I find that memory, and it's like there's a movie of it, and I plug that in and I play it. Well, that's not the way it is at all.
No, that's not. We talk about some of the earlier models of memory in the book, and one is the leaky bucket model. So you can think of memory just as a homogeneous substance like a fluid, and it gets transferred from a very leaky bucket to a less leaky bucket. We can think of that as the two bucket model. But again, it's very, very important to remember that long-term memory is well organized. And so much of the work of memory is organizing things in short-term memory into a meaningful system of relationships, which then gets codified. And a good example of that, actually, a good model or metaphor for that middle piece, that relation, the relationality element or the relator, might be Google. The neuroscientist Howard Eichenbaum, who studies a place in the brain called the hippocampus, and the hippocampus, we think, is the thing that makes these relationships. He has likened the hippocampus to Google, which is something that records relationships between things, specifically the relationships between websites. So when you put in a keyword, and Google has this web, this huge web, this, you know, it is a sense represented the whole World Wide Web system of relationships, and it searches that web for the connections that you might be looking for. While our hippocampus might do something similar, it might record relationships between things in short-term memory, and somehow we convert that system of relationships into a long-term representation. Mm-hmm. So, you know, you can think of the transfer from short-term to long-term memory as going from a more disruptible, more leaky store to a less disruptible, less changeable store. But in between is the system that makes meaning. Mm-hmm.
Well, just, and I don't know, again, if I'm going into a different area, but then to me, though, are you really talking about, even with long-term memory, that it's stored in pieces, and that when you're remembering something, you actually have to, your brain actually has to take the pieces and assemble them into some little story that makes sense, which may also be why, you know, part of the explanation for the fact that memory is actually really unreliable, and that we think we have these really solid memories of things that has happened, but it's easily documentable and has that our memories really aren't as good as we think that they are.
Right. So you bring up a couple of interesting points. The first, well, maybe the second point you brought up was that memory really is unreliable. And a well-known psychologist named Elizabeth Loftus demonstrated that beautifully in a series of experiments, that memory truly is unreliable, and that in fact false memories can be implanted into the memory of an individual. So for example, she would have relatives of an individual tell the individual meretriciously, right, falsely, that certain things happened to her in her past that never really happened, but she would integrate them into her story about herself. So that when she told a story about herself, she would even tell people that, oh, one day at the family picnic, I got sick on deviled eggs, when in fact that never really happened. Mm-hmm. So, yes, false memories can be definitely implanted in individuals and presumably in collective memory also. Mm-hmm. The idea of this element of relationality, that the hippocampus is a relator, is a relatively newer idea. by Howard Eichenbaum and Neil Cohen and others. And so one of our contributions was to say, look, you know, you really need this relationality element and insert it between the short-term store and the long-term store, because the long-term store isn't just a list. It's really a system of relationships. But our main contribution was to say, you know, this framework, short-term memory, relationships, long-term memory, can be applied to collective memory formation. That when collective memory, when a collective forms a memory, what does it do? It takes a bunch of facts, like that you might hear in the news, that you report on NPR every day constantly, these isolated facts in the news. Then certain people will try to fit those facts together. They'll try to make sense of them, like the opinion leaders in a society, for example, academics, politicians, radio hosts. And then from that system of relationships, society might form a more coherent narrative about what's going on or what had happened in the past. So we would say that precisely the same thing that happens in the brain in forming long-term memories happens also on the collective level.
Let me just very quickly, for people who might have tuned in, introduce again our guest, Tom Anastasio. He is associate professor in the Department of Molecular and Integrative Physiology. He's also a member of the Beckman Institute for Advanced Science and Technology, and is one of the authors of a book that explores this territory we're talking about, Individual and Collective Memory Consolidation, How This Business of Memory Works for Individuals and for Groups of People. And here also we have one of the co-authors of the book, Wenyu Zheng, who is working on PhD in anthropology here at University of Illinois and was part of this. And as we talk, by the way, questions are welcome, 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. Well, I wanted to bring you into the conversation here. Now, so you're an anthropologist. Tell me, what about this interests you? How do you come to this work?
In anthropology, I've been interested in connective memory for a long time. And one of my biggest questions for my doctoral dissertation is how to understand individuals' ideas can be transformed into a social idea that influences a lot of people. And I found my dissertation topic overlap with Professor Anastasio's project. So this is how I can join this project.
Yeah. And very specifically, what you I know what you're interested in is this question of, well, how is it that as a society you form your memories of what the past of that society has been, and how is it that some things are remembered and how is it some things are forgotten or don't, you know, they don't become part of the memory? And that obviously can be very, very important with a society that that you have an accurate memory of what has happened.
Wenyu, maybe you should describe the third part of the book where we tested our hypothesis by looking at Chinese collective memory.
Mm-hmm. Sure. The third part of our book tries to test our model of memory, how memory is formed. And we look at how cultural revolution interrupts this memory consolidation process. And the cultural revolution targeted at the part we call relators, those meaning makers, who select information from the past and make connections between those label memory items to the accepted knowledge.
In other words, the social hippocampus.
Yeah, their social hippocampus.
So we hypothesize this thing called the social hippocampus, which is like the analogous to the individual hippocampus, which is the thing that makes these relationships that are so important to the memory formation process.
So that's, I think this is a really interesting idea. So that it's the idea that there, within a society, that there are certain people who are very important to forming collective memory, and they're teachers and artists and journalists and college professors, people who do that kind of work. And I suppose the thing is that if you decided that you really want to rewrite the past or write something right out of the past, if you take those folks who have that function, and you're saying that it's sort of like that function of this part of the brain, if you take those people away, then there's no way for those experiences to become part of the social memory, of the collective consciousness. Because right. because of the way it works, the path that it goes along, you've disrupted the path by taking this very important part out. And literally in China, of course, those people were literally taken out, and that's what happened.
Well, I always wondered, you know, I'm in my mid-50s, and so the Cultural Revolution is something that happened during my lifetime, and then other similar processes in other parts of the world, Soviet Russia, for example. Mm-hmm. And I had always wondered, why did the regimes target academics? Why did they go after these bespectacled people in academics? Why did they take them out of their ivory towers and send them to jail, in some cases even kill them? What was so important about them, I wondered. Now after doing this research, it's clear to me. They're the ones who make the collective memory. They're the relators. They're the ones who establish a set of relationships, which then becomes codified into the collective memory, the longer-term collective memory of a society. Mm-hmm. And memory is so important. Because what does memory do in an individual or in a collective? It's the basis for decision and action. When an individual or a society comes to a crossroads and says, well, what shall I do? What shall we do? Well, a lot of times we draw from our memory and say, we are the people who are, I am the person who are, this is my identity. This is my individual identity. This is my cultural identity. I will act in a way that is consistent with that. So in a sense, it really is the memory of a society that directs the society. Even more so than the military. You know, you can go into a society and leave the military alone. Just change its cultural view of itself, and you can completely move the direction that society moves in. So it became clear to me why Mao, for example, would target the individuals that he did after we did this research. And Wenyi, I think, just did a beautiful job. And so did the other authors, Kristen Ehrenberger and Patrick Watson. Kristen is a candidate in history, and Patrick Watson is a candidate in psychology. They kind of helped lay the groundwork for the testing of the hypothesis that Wenyi did in the last section, where Wenyi really went into detail and looked specifically at the ways in which the Cultural Revolution, where Mao deliberately removed the existing social hippocampus, looked specifically at how certain memories in Chinese society were literally lost. Yeah.
One thing I want to add is Mao just not simply remove the previous social hippocampus. He replaced the previous one with a new one, the communist one. And the communist one did the similar work of selecting previous memory items and make connections. But they select different kind of memory items and consolidate different things.
Hmm. Well, for you then, as an anthropologist that was interested in this process, does having this kind of model help you to understand it? What did you learn that helps you in your work as an anthropologist by taking a look at the brain and how it works?
For me, the most interesting part of this model is the middle. We have three box model, and mm-hmm. the middle box, the relators. This part is extremely important because we anthropologists in our fieldwork, during most of the time, we worked with the. For example, if I worked with a remote worked in a remote village, and during most of my field time, I will work with village specialists, the leaders in the village, and those people, their opinion are taken seriously by other villagers. They were meaning makers.
So then as an anthropologist, you go into study some group of individual. You're doing your field work. Your most important informants are going to be the people who occupied this position.
Yeah.
The opinion makers of that society.
Yeah. And from them we can gain a big picture of the society. After we get this we can verify those by asking questions from ordinary villagers. Mm-hmm. So I guess the relator part is really kind of something we anthropologists always do in fieldwork.
I have a couple of callers here to bring in the conversation. Why don't we do that? And we'll maybe I'll mention that the numbers again in case people would like to join in with questions or comments. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. You can also send us an email, will-talk@illinois.edu. We have a couple of callers here. We'll start with the first person in line, and that's someone in Champaign on our line number 4. Hello.
Yeah, hi, David. Very interesting show. The topic is going someplace I didn't expect. So I had a couple of general questions about memory, and so if it's out of the depth of your guests, go ahead and just disregard it. But I had just a couple of general questions about memory itself. A couple of things that I've heard and read is that the human being is hardwired basically for self-preservation, where we have a tendency to skew memory and relate it to the positive. In other words, you may not remember specific events of your past, those maybe that are painful or harmful, and that's by design to kind of preserve our well-being, I suppose. And then the positive events that have happened, we have a tendency to embellish those basically for the same reasons. But the specific question is, and I don't know, again, if it's out of the depth of this conversation, I'm thinking about people. Mary Lou Henner comes to mind, where you can give them a specific date and time in the future, 10, 15, 20 years ago, and they can remember exact details. And I'm wondering if that's something that is just a unique ability, or is that something that we all have if we can just harvest it? And I'll go ahead and listen and leave that for comment.
Okay. There. Well, I think those are two interesting questions. We'll see what we can do with those.
Okay. Let me try the second one first. Yeah, there are some individuals who seem to remember all the details. So in short-term memory, for a short term, we have a list of details. We just have a list of facts. And some people seem to be able to remember all of those facts. They don't seem to condense them down. They don't seem to generalize from them. They don't seem to establish a system of relationships, a more abstract system of relationships, and store that. Instead, what appears to go into long-term memory is literally the list of facts, unprocessed. I'm not a memory expert, but clearly that ability or phenomenon is very rare. Most people can't do that. In fact, I'm not sure that most people would even want to. When you ask an individual who has that kind of memory, do they like it or not, they might say no, not necessarily. You know, they might actually feel dragged down by it in some ways or feel a little bit maybe overburdened by it. And it's very interesting that there's a character called Funes the Memorious, who was one of Borges's characters. And Funes apparently could remember every single detail. He couldn't see the forest for the trees. He just remembered every single detail. And Borges very, I think, beautifully illustrates in his story about Funes the Memorious why this is a problem. So Funes, for example, couldn't form general categories. Now, individuals who we know who have this kind of memory can form general categories. Funes was a fictional character who couldn't. But he couldn't understand how, you know, a particular dog, a particular individual dog, seen from one angle versus another was the same creature, let alone understand the general category of dog. So I think in general, memorizing every single fact doesn't necessarily help us in survival. What we'd rather do is condense from all these facts some more usable representation. So what we find in long-term memory tends to be a usable representation. And collective memory scholars have identified this on the collective level. Virch, anthropologist Virch, has coined this term usable past, that what a society tries to do is to create in its collective long-term memory a so-called usable past, which is a story about the past, not every single fact, but a story about the past. And the first issue that you brought up about has to do with memory inaccuracies. You know, would we tend to enhance the positive? You know, it's definitely true, definitely true, that individuals distort the past, they distort the past for their own purposes. Now, sometimes they do accentuate the positive. Some psychologists have identified this tendency for people to want to promote the narrative of their continuous improvement. They want to say that they want to feel that they're improving over time. So they'll look back into their past and say something that happened in the past, maybe that they were proud of. Well, they're not so proud of that anymore. They're more proud of something that's more recent in their memory. But sometimes people will actually accentuate the negative for their own reasons. And a very good example comes from the psychologist Ulrich Neisser, who studied an interview with Dean of Watergate fame. John Dean, who was involved in Watergate. And, you know, many years after the incident, psychologists interviewed Dean about his experience in Watergate. And they found that Dean pretty much recounted the facts accurately, that he didn't distort the facts so much. Interestingly, what he distorted was his role in the events. And in his recollection, he played a much bigger role in those events than he actually did. And so this leaves psychologists asking, you know, why would someone want to accentuate their role in a crime? But he did, for his own reasons, for his own personal who knows what reasons, his emotional reasons or whatever. In his story, in his rendition of it, he played a bigger role than he actually played. Maybe it was a desire somehow to grab a bigger piece of history, even if it was bad history, than he really played. So in our model, I've been stressing the transfer from short-term memory to long-term memory with a relator, this hippocampus, this individual relator, which we think is analogous to the social relator in between. But it's also, but our model also has another box, a big encompassing box, which we call the entity being the person or group who's doing the remembering. And this entity will bring to bear non-memory factors into the memory formation process, like goals, plans, emotions, a sense of coherence, for example, and also a desire to feel maybe more important, maybe that you're improving over time, you know, other emotions, other feelings that will color, that will in a sense distort the memory formation process and make it inaccurate, but in a way that kind of serves the purposes of the entity.
And you can see how that happens. It serves the purposes of the individual entity because we want to think well of ourselves. We want to think we're significant. But then if you have an entity like a society, well, it also has its ends. It has maybe political goals that it wants to satisfy, a certain set of principles that it believes in, and that it, you know, so it wants, and it maybe it wants to construct a version of the past that's consistent with its political goals and principles, which is something clearly that happened in China.
Yeah, in our case study, during the Cultural Revolution, the entity part in our model, we can say it refers to the Mao's idea of establishing a communist society. And because of this goal, the relator, the Mao's scholars, Mao's followers, they actually do is to rewrite the whole past according to their class struggle theory. So this entity really influenced the relators, what they can select or what they want to include into people's memory.
Yeah. That's very interesting. Well, I tell you, we're at our midpoint here. We have another call we'll get to in just a moment. We'll be talking some more with our guests on this hour, Atom Anastasio and Wenyu Zhang. We'll do that after a very short break. This is Focus.
On the next Fresh Air, the secret history of America's 30-year conflict with Iran. We talk with David Crist about his new book, The Twilight War, based on hundreds of interviews and on documents he got released through the Freedom of Information Act. Crist himself observed a close call while serving with special ops forces. Join us.
This afternoon at 1 and this evening at 7 on AM 580.
This is a rebroadcast of a previous Focus program, so as you listen, keep in mind, we will not be taking calls.
In this hour of Focus, we're talking about memory, how it works on both the level of the individual and the level of the society. And I have here in the studio two guests, Tom Anastasio. He is associate professor in the Department of Molecular and Integrative Physiology at University of Illinois. He's also a member of the Beckman Institute for Advanced Science and Technology. He and several PhD candidates here at University of Illinois, among them Wenyu Zhang, who is here with us too. He's a PhD candidate in anthropology. They worked on this project looking at these two things and drawing some making some comparisons between the way memory works on the individual level and on the collective level, and they have written a book about this. So if you'd like to explore this in greater detail, you can look at their book, which is titled Individual and Collective Memory Consolidation, and it is published by the MIT Press. I have a caller here who's been a patient, so we'll get to them. They're in Urbana on line number one. Hello.
This is a fascinating topic. I hung on so long because I've done a lot of research and teaching of personal narratives and autobiographies. And the question I had relates somewhat to the story you were telling about Mr. Dean and how when he was remembering the Watergate crime, he was elevating himself into, you know, assuming a much larger role. Well, since that was a very public story and it's in American history, we can fact-check Mr. Dean. You know, you were saying he was wrong here or he didn't play a larger part and you were questioning why he would do that. Well, my question is, what do you do with stories where you really don't, with people who are not as, you know, famous as he was, and so you don't really have any way to fact-check? And I'm asking that question because it's my understanding that some psychiatrists will encourage their patients to write their stories down, their autobiography, their life story, as part of their treatment. Earlier in the show, you talked about a student or young woman who's had a memory of not being able to eat a certain type of food, and then she realized eventually that her family was telling her that, but she really didn't experience that kind of thing. So I guess my larger question is, how do we fact check? I mean, how do we, you know, either verify, or how do we handle these stories where we're not sure if what they're telling us, what they remember, what someone has planted in their memory, et cetera, et cetera?
Okay. There are two things that we can, that come to mind. The first is the work of Elizabeth Loftus, who studied very systematically false memories in people. And it's interesting that you bring up the role of psychiatrists, and psychiatrists will ask people to go back into their memories and remember things. Mm-hmm. Well, the question that Elizabeth Loftus asked was, can psychiatrists and psychologists implant memories? Mm-hmm. Can they make a person remember things that didn't really happen? And Elizabeth Loftus was very controversially involved in the sexual abuse litigations. And she found that because of certain facts that came out, that occasionally a psychiatrist, a psychologist, or a public health worker could lead an individual to believe that they had been sexually abused when in fact they had not. So her work in that area was very, very widely cited, very, very controversial. And if you're interested, I'd refer you to it. Elizabeth Loftus, she writes very well. Another thing that comes to mind when you ask about, you know, people who aren't famous, you know, you want to know their story and you want to know what happened. You have to assume that there's some inaccuracies in their memory. What do you do about that?
Mm-hmm.
Well, anthropologists have had to confront that problem. And I should probably bring Wen Yi in on this. But, you know, a lot of their work involves interviewing people. They just have to sit down with people who don't have written records. Their tradition is largely oral. How do they know what happened really is true? And we do reference another book in the beginning of our book that talks about those kinds of methods, the methods that anthropologists use mm-hmm. to kind of get around that qualitative problem. And Wen Yi does this in his research, so I bet he has some interesting things to say about that.
Okay. on the connect, because our individual does not live alone, so his or her life experience can be observed by others. So on a connected level, when we try to do fact check, we can compare, for example, in our case study, we compare the China or mainland who experienced Cultural Revolution that influenced their memory consolidation, and also with people in Taiwan who didn't experience Cultural Revolution and their memory consolidation was not interrupted. Mm. And we consider the Taiwanese memory of Chinese culture as kind of normalized 100% memory of China, of Chinese traditional culture. So by this kind of comparison, we can do kind of fact check on a collective level. And I think that these kind of similar techniques works also on the individual level. We do connect, compare.
Okay. Do you have a, is your book, I'm sorry, I don't remember if you said your book was already published. Is it something I can get access to?
Sure. Yeah, it's out now. MIT Press. Anything else you want to say about it, Tom?
Well, yes, I'd like to mention that this project was generously funded by the Beckman Foundation. I'm a member of the Beckman Institute, and the Beckman Foundation provided support for four students, well, one of whom dropped out, but for Wen Yi, also Patrick Watson, a PhD student in neuroscience, and for Kristen Ehrenberger, a PhD student in history, for us to do this project.
Okay.
And in fact, if you ever go to the Beckman Institute, there's a little book stand near the cafe, and there's a copy of the copy of our book there if you wanted to check it out.
Convenient there, for conveniently
okay.
available for purchase.
Not for purchase, just to check out.
Oh, to,
just to look at.
For browsing purposes.
Browsing.
Okay, well, can you give me the title one more time? I'm sorry, I didn't get it when it was mentioned.
Sure. The title of the book is Individual and Collective Memory Consolidation.
Okay.
Doesn't exactly trip off the tongue.
Right? No.
There you go.
All right. Thank you. I'll hang up and let someone else get on. Thank you.
Well, I think, though, the question that the caller raises is a great one, and I'm sure that it does indeed apply to anthropology or to any case where you sit somebody down and you have them tell you about some experience. And then if you're going to try to verify that, what really can you do other than ask anybody that you can think of that person knows or that knows them? So, you know, asking me about my childhood, well, okay, I'll tell you some story. But then you ask my dad, you ask my sister, you try to dig up all my childhood friends. You do whatever you can to get other people to tell you about the same thing and see how the stories line up. And I'm sure that it's the same with an anthropologist. You know, you go into a place. So you start asking people questions. You ask, what's this? What's that? What did this mean? Why did you do that? And if you're lucky, they'll tell you stuff. But you always have to say, okay, am I getting the straight story here? Well, then what else can you do but go ask as many other people as you can the same questions and see if you get the same answers and see how they line up.
And we can ask the same question to the same person in different contexts. They
and
tell you the different. They tell a different version of the same story. So by comparing those different versions, we can verify.
Say, will they give you the same answer every time you ask the question? Indeed. All right. We have some other folks here to talk with. Let's go to Champagne and line number two. Hello.
Yeah, I also have a sister that family memories that are very different. We talk about my older sister and I as having independent reality, and we're the oldest of 11, so we're the keepers of the flames, but they're different flames. Mm. But the one thing I wanted to ask you about was, you know, the Cultural Revolution example that you studied is really a case of manipulation of the process. But it seems that that this process is very akin to cultural evolution that evolutionary biologists might talk about, and the replicator being the meme instead of the gene. You know, Dawkins wrote about it and other people. And that rather than a manipulated process, you might often have cultural drift or memory drift, which, culture gradually changes over time through this process of imperfect memory and memory givers or the authority figures passing it down differently. Does that make sense?
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. It's interesting that precisely the same point that you're bringing up was brought up by one of the reviewers of our book. We actually had some excellent and extensive and pretty critical reviews of our book, and one of the suggestions was that we talk about evolution and the idea of memes, and to make a long story short, we decided not to discuss memes in our book. For one thing, a meme on the cultural level for us was kind of hard to define. You know, what is that piece
Right.
What would correspond?
Like the genes are hard to define.
Yeah, genes are a little easier to define. Memes are tough. And so we were afraid to open that can of worms. But of course, the idea of memes, cultural memes, is very strong, and you know, it somehow manages to get passed from one generation to another. But we were taking a different tack. We were looking at maybe you could think of the items in short-term memory as memes, but we couldn't really map that. We really couldn't map our theory to the evolutionary theory very well, and so we made the decision not to try to. But the point that you're raising is a very good one, and it's one that has been brought up by our reviewers.
Right, and that the process is, I mean, the cultural evolution, I mean, the Chinese example is a manipulation example, but that it can be either a benign or really a drifting kind of process.
Well, I should hand this off to Wen Yi, but as he mentioned, there was an existing relator of Chinese culture, and Chinese culture was undergoing transformation, and these relators were very, very busy, continuing to shape Chinese cultural memory. And Mao came in and pretty much removed that relator and did replace it by one of his own.
Right.
And so manipulated a cultural memory formation in a very, very serious and direct way by eliminating one relator and replacing it with another. And indeed, Chinese collective memory continued to develop, but under the influence now of a state-sponsored social hippocampus.
Right. Well, thank you very much.
Go ahead. Wen Yi, you wanted to add on to that point?
Tom just said what I wanted to say, but I want to add one point that...
Yes.
After the Cultural Revolution, we say Cultural Revolution is manipulated, but after the Cultural Revolution, the society gradually established a new kind of relator, and then this new kind of relator gradually brought a lot of previously neglected memory items back into Chinese memory of history. And this indicates that the manipulation part is actually the relator, what relators do.
Oh, sure. So it's just a matter of, you know, one person's ideas about what's important to you. So your principles, your philosophy, your politics, whatever. I mean, that's always going to be a filter that you as the relator are going to run things through. So, you know, one relator's got one set of priorities and another relator's got another set of priorities. So that, but what you're saying is that, well, that's just where relators do. And if you go back to the brain, you'd have to say, well, that's what the relator in the brain has to do. It goes back to this idea was you got to filter somehow.
You've got to filter and relate and make some sense out of it,
yeah.
Provide meaning to it. Another thing that our reviewers brought up was George Orwell, who said, who controls the present controls the past. And so we're able to couch that in our terms. We can say that who controls the present can control collective memory formation in various ways. By deciding what gets introduced into short-term memory, how it's related, what importance is placed on it, how frequently it's presented to the population. And we use our model to kind of illustrate how a regime could manipulate collective memory formation. Yeah.
We have about 5-6 minutes. We have some other callers, and we'll continue, and we'll talk next with someone in Urbana, and this is line number 3. Hello.
Hello. Is this me?
Yes.
You use the word stories a great deal, and I have a particular interest in narratives and the construction of narratives, how narratives put things into context, how they make meaning. Is there any role in your research and model for a concept of narrative construction, constructing a story about an event or about a personal life experience that puts it in a framework that relates the parts of it?
Absolutely. The narrative is the archetype of a generalized long-term memory structure, would be a narrative. So you take a bunch of facts and you weave them together into a story that has a beginning and a middle and an end, and it has temporality and emplotment. We discuss this at length in the book. The narrative is probably the most common form of a long-term memory structure, that you take a bunch of facts and relate them into a story and then store the story. But there are lots of other types of frameworks, the narrative being probably the most prominent one. But scientifically, we would also tell a story. You know, you might tell the story about how molecules interact, right? Or how you know, light waves propagate. And that's a story, too. It's a theory. It doesn't really have a beginning, middle, and end. It doesn't really have temporality and emplotment. What it is a bunch of facts that are related together in some scientific framework, which is coherent and reasonable, and then that gets stored. So it's not really in the form of a narrative, as we normally think of a story, but it's still a very well-organized framework. And you could kind of think of it as, like, the story of chemistry or the story of physics.
Yeah, but you could call it, if you expand the definition of narrative and, you know, of telling a consistent story that relate different parts and not necessarily one that has a plot that's resolved at the end, then more things could be considered within a narrative framework. Anyway, I think that's great. I love the idea that narrative is so prominent. Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you. On again to another caller here. This is Champaign County and someone on line number one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Line one.
Yes.
Comment on different language learning and how someone got a grant to study how languages are difficult or different. For example, in China, what's the difference between the spoken dialects? Are they just like Spanish and French, or are they more far apart like German and Greek? And also comment on dyslexia. Is there dyslexia in Chinese language? Thanks.
That's a little far afield from what we're talking about this morning. I don't know if you can make any answer to that. We might just have to say that we'd have to save a question like that for another day.
I was educated in modern vernacular language, so I think my spoken language is kind of similar to the written language of Chinese.
Fair enough. I think that's about all we can do with the questions. Other questions certainly are welcome. Someone wants to call real quick because we're getting near the end. 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. We've just sketched out a little bit about what is in the book that you have written, and there are a lot of interesting ideas in here, so people can pursue that and look at it in greater depth. One thing that I'm interested in is having taken the model that gets applied to the individual and the human brain and how things go from memories are consolidated, and applying that to the idea of a collective memory. Does any of this feed back to the individual again and do anything for improving your understanding of what happens with consolidation in individuals? Or is that fairly settled so some new insight into that process is not going to come?
No, we hope that our theory does provide hypotheses both on the individual and collective level. Our hope was that by looking at individual and collective memory and by making an analogy between them, that each level could inform the other and each level could help to generate hypotheses about what might be going on in individual and collective memory. So, for example, in collective memory, collective memory is visible. It happens on the level of discourse. And so the relationality element can be observed. And what relationality often involves, as James Verge famously said, is conflict and negotiation, are his terms, right? So, you know, this formation of relationships can be very arduous, as Thomas Kuhn said of the formation of scientific collective memory. So we might ask, is there a process of competition or of competition and cooperation at work in the formation of these relationships in individual brains? There are neural circuits that compete and cooperate. We can describe them very accurately. They've been observed in other parts of the brain. One hypothesis, even on the neurophysiological level, is whether competition and cooperation is at work in the formation of relationships between items and whether that's part of the memory formation process. Yeah. On the collective level, I think I would say that we make an even bigger contribution because collective memory, being composed of individual memories acting in synergy, is much more complicated than individual memory. And we think just the concept of collective memory consolidation will help humanists understand the phenomenon of collective memory better.
So as far as the model, the consolidation model that you outlined, where you have your short-term memory, you have your relator, the hippocampus that's in the middle, that decides what gets incorporated into long-term memory. And then you have your bigger box, which may be a set of framing principles that maybe influence the relator and how it does its job. Having said all that, then there still apparently are – maybe is there some mystery or some unknowns associated with exactly the how in the brain, in the human brain, that relator function happens? How exactly – what exactly is going on in that in-between box?
Oh, absolutely. The hippocampus is a great mystery. It's a central part of the brain. It's central to the memory formation process. There are famous patients, like the patient HM, who had his hippocampus removed, probably the world's most famous neuropsychiatric patient of all time. We're still just beginning to learn about what the hippocampus does. And in our wildest dreams, through our theory, by observing relationality on the collective level, perhaps some new insights into how the hippocampus works could emerge. That's a big perhaps, but it's not out of the question.
Well, we're going to have to stop because we have come to the end of the time. And for people who would like to read more on the subject, you can look for this book. We've talked about Individual and Collective Memory Consolidation. It is published by the MIT Press by Tom Anastasio. He's associate professor in the Department of Molecular and Integrative Physiology, also member of the Beckman Institute for Advanced Science. And he has three other co-authors, Kirsten Ehrenberger, Patrick Watson, and Wenyi Zhang, who is here with us as well. He's a PhD candidate in anthropology here at University of Illinois. And thank you very much for being here.
Thank you, David. It was a pleasure.
Featuring the Subaru. Support for today's broadcast comes from Subaru of Champaign County, featuring the Subaru Impreza, with standard all-wheel drive and an EPA highway rating of 36 mpg, depending on conditions. More information is available at SubaruofChampaign.com or at their location on Route 45 in Savoy.
You've been listening to a program from the Focus Archives. Much of our local productions, including past interviews from Focus and local news features, are available on our website anytime you want to listen at will.illinois.edu. At this point, we'll take our usual break for news, and then Focus will continue, so please stay tuned. Coming up in the next hour of Focus, a conversation from January of this year with Dr. Adam Winkler, professor of constitutional law at the University of California, Los Angeles, about his book Gunfight, The Battle Over the Right to Bear Arms in America. A particularly timely subject to listen to, a conversation to listen to again from January of this year. That's following the news. Stay with us.
Agricultural programs are made possible by Risk Management Commodities Incorporated, headquartered in Lafayette, Indiana, with branches in Chalmers, Indiana, and Hudsonville, Illinois, providing independent commodity, financial, and currency analysis to its clients and newsletter subscribers. On the web at myrmconline.com.
And now with the latest numbers in the commodity markets, here's Illinois Public Media's Sean Powers. Sean.
Thanks, Craig. September Kansas City winter wheat trading, 870.5, down 43.5. December, 887.5, down 42. September Chicago wheat trading, 856.5, down 56.25. December, 868, down 51. September corn trading, 774, down 40. December, 748, down 38.75. March, 741.5, down 35. August soybeans, 1628.5, down 70. September, 1577.75, down 70. November, 1552.25, down 70. August soybean meal, $4.98, down 25. September, $4.78.30, down 30. August soybean oil, $51.96, down $1.79. September, $52.16, down $1.80. August live cattle, $118.55, down 5 cents. October, $122.90, down 60 cents. August feeder cattle, $137.67.5, down $2.02.5. September, $140.150, up, $2.42.5. August lean hogs, $92.67.5, down 65 cents. And October, $78.10, down 75 cents. The extreme heat.